Hi, my name's Ron Frenz, and you are listening to the Cave of Solitude podcast.
Podcasting from the megacity metropolis of Toronto, you are listening to the Cave of Solitude. I am your host, Eric Anthony, and we're very happy that you joined us for this very special episode 86. And this week, the good folks over here in the Cave of Solitude and my buddy over at the Fastball Special, Mr. Martin Slam Duncan, bring you another great interview with acclaimed comic book artist, Mr. Ron Frenz. Now, if you've been a comic book fan for the last 30 years, especially in the 80s and 90s, you are well aware and have definitely been impacted by the exciting and cosmic visuals of Mr. Ron Frenz. Now, I remember as a kid growing up, specific Superman annuals that were written by John Byrne and Roger Stern, which both of those guys are legends in their own right. I remember seeing Ron Frenz's pencils in those books, and this was before I could read. So this, my memories of his visuals take me back to a really warm and fuzzy place, and it was such a privilege to be able to talk to him. Now, Ron Frenz was a frequent collaborator with the legendary Tom DeFalco, and they're the team that originally brought you the black costume Spider-Man in the main title, Amazing Spider-Man, back when Secret Wars was taking place, which was a big deal back in that in those days, and today is also very exciting for fans and collectors to talk about and search out those books. Now, they followed that run up by taking over the reins of the mighty Thor and his trusty hammer Mjolnir for a legendary 7 years. Yes, that's right, 7 years on Thor. So needless to say, there was a lot of ground to cover and questions to ask Mr. Frenz. And let me tell you, not only was he extremely generous with his time, but very forthcoming with us, giving great answers and insight into his creative process, some of his various inspirations as an artist, and even giving us a good understanding of comics as far as craft is concerned. And it was a lot of, it was very insightful, because a lot of times you think you understand comics a certain way, and then you get to talk to some of these guys who've been creating and were inspired from the legendary creators like Jack Kirby and John Buscema, you know, the students of those guys who kind of share their craft with you, and it puts a whole new understanding or perspective of how comics once were and how they could be and what it was that we originally fell in love with when we read comics, and how sometimes today those elements are missing. So it was so much fun to be able to talk to Mr. Frenz. And just so you're aware, this episode is probably one of our longest episodes, especially interviews. I edited nothing out. Everything here is good content. I enjoyed it, and I'm sure that you will as well. So just an editor's note before we begin, this was a phone interview conversation that we had with Ron Frenz, so my vocals at times can be a little bit subdued, a little bit low, but thankfully you hear Ron loud and clear. All of his answers are very, very clear and understandable, so if you can't hear me as well when I'm talking, that's not really important, that's not why you're here, but if you see that my mic is a little bit low, that is the reason why. So without any further ado, this is the Cave of Solitude, Eric Anthony, and we are proud to bring to you our conversation with the one and only Ron Frenz. So it is our honor and privilege this week to welcome to the show the artist who had Spider-Man swinging through New York City in all black everything, as well as the man who had Captain America Steve Rogers be worthy enough to lift and hold Mjolnir. He is the one and only Ron Frenz. Welcome to the show, Ron. Thanks so much for joining us. A real privilege to have you with us.
Well, thank you very much. It's an honor and a privilege to be here, and I'm a little embarrassed by how overstated that was, especially since I might have just been driving the car. I mean, you know, Tom DeFalco takes some credit blame, Brett Breeding takes some credit blame, you know, all that kind of stuff. But yeah. I thank you very much for the intro.
Oh, absolutely. I didn't realize, like, I was a fan of a lot of your work, but I didn't realize until I was maybe in my mid-20s and going through my comic book collection and seeing how many of your work was part of my childhood. That was like the things that I would just look at the pictures constantly, even before I could read. So, I mean, your Spider-Man and your Superman is, you know, the things I associate with those characters a lot of the time. So
You did a lot of good driving.
Well, that's very flattering. I appreciate that. It's one of my favorite things about what I get to do, what I've gotten the privilege of doing for the last 34, 35 years, is that you do hear that from people, that you get to be a part of their childhood. You get to be a part of their, warm sense of history and all that kind of stuff. And I that's great. I it's more than I ever imagined it could be, as far as it makes you feel great that you're a part of somebody's positive memories, you know.
Yeah. I listen to a lot of comic book fans and collectors, and I listened to a show recently where a bunch of guys were talking about their favorite comic book stories from their childhood, and every memory was so warm and had to do with, their parents purchasing the book or reading it to them. And to have that experience, to be part of that generation who enjoyed comics that way, it's pretty special, because I think some of that is kind of fading away the way comic books are now. It's lost a little bit of that magic that we had.
Well, for one thing, I don't think the kids that are as young as we were when we discovered comics are discovering comics that young anymore. They're introduced to the characters through cartoons and through movies and all the other media that's out there. But I don't think, with the kind of material that's being done, kids are actually discovering comics at 6, 7, and 8 like we did, So I think that's going to cut into some of that a little bit. But, it's one of the things I've discovered. I've only been on Facebook since beginning of the year, since like February or March. And one of the things that, if you ever get to the sense in having worked in comics and having had the career that I've had, if I ever get the sense that it's about me, being on Facebook has disavowed me of that, because it really is, and I mean that in the most positive way, because people aren't, the kind of posts that I see in response to my posts, the kind of comments I get, are exactly what you were just talking about. I remember getting on my bike and driving to the local mom and pop store, or the local 7-Eleven, and picking up that issue along with a nice tea and reading it. It's amazing how these things viscerally tie in to the people's personal stories, and it's there. The posts that I do that are a little bit more behind the scenes, or a little bit more about, where I was coming from, there's some nice warm responses to it, but you don't get the kind of response you do when it's something like the black costume or some of the most likes I've gotten have just been a single image that connects with people, and you hear those kinds of personal stories, and that's what it's all about. It's been a real interesting experience for me to realize. I don't think I realized before, how personal of a connection those memories are, and that there's a word I'm trying to think of while I'm talking, but it's not working. But it's that, people's private stories, people's personal stories that are tied into this kind of stuff. So it's really humbling to be a part of it. It really is.
So do you do a lot of the Comic-Cons and appearances as well?
When I was younger, I did a lot of them. When I was in my 20s and in my 20s and 30s, I traveled quite a bit. Pretty much anybody that invited me, I said yes and did it. I don't enjoy the traveling as much anymore. Of course, unfortunately, the shows aren't throwing the kind of money around that they used to, and quite often a lot of the shows I'm invited to would require me to drive, and I'm not as willing to do that as I used to be. So I really, since I don't have a lot to push, I really haven't been doing a lot of shows. One of the projects I'm working on, I'm sure we'll get to it later as far as what I'm working on now, we should be starting a rollout of the books, of the physical books. They're available on online at this point with Comixology and such. But when the books start rolling out physically, I'm planning on getting back into harness and doing more shows. But with the ones I do, it's always a pleasure. It's always been a pleasure to meet the fans and to, thank them for paying my rent. it really is something that, I tend to be a little bit more social than some of the people that are drawn to this industry, and it really means a lot to me to get out of my studio and interact with people and thank them for enjoying the work and keeping me going for all these years, you know.
Well, Toronto's not too far.
Yeah, I was just about to say.
I've been to Toronto a couple of times. I've been blown away the times I went to Montreal and Toronto. Montreal, I actually got treated like an idiot in a McDonald's by a French-speaking gentleman, which was humbling. But what I remember about Toronto is you could eat off the streets. I was so stunned. It's such a gorgeous city, and it was so clean. It was just amazing. Everywhere I looked, it looks like somebody had just gone through there and swept it. You know, I mean, it was just, I was very impressed with the city. So Toronto is a beautiful, beautiful place.
Well, we'll put in a word with the coordinator. We've been able to talk to him, and he said, if you guys have any suggestions of people you'd like to have come, just let me know. So we're going to let him know that we want.
Well, I don't know what kind of a draw I would be these days, given that, you know, it's been a while since I've had regular work on the stands, and, you know, I don't know what kind of demographic they're shooting for with the shows. I don't know what kind of demographic they're shooting for with the publishing anymore. So, you know, I may be at one point. I don't know when it happens, but at some point people start referring to you as a legend. And it becomes, and it's a double-edged sword, because it's like, well, okay, I'm a legend. But, you know, does that mean I'm not allowed to do any more work? That kind of thing. Because I think most of us would, trade the whole legend thing for being, an active working freelancer, you know, so.
Well, a few years ago, at the Toronto Comic Con that they hold in March, they had the team that did Secret Wars. So Mike Zeck was a pretty big draw because, you know, the whole Spider-Man symbiote suit, the first appearance.
Sure. For so many things, not just Secret Wars, but Kraven's Last Hunt and all that kind of stuff, sure.
Right. Absolutely. So, but the thing you see most when people go up to meet him and ask him is about the symbiote suit a lot of the time, right? So people are going to, if Ron Frenz is there and it's the you know, ASM 252, you're still going to be a draw. I'm pretty sure of that.
Well, I'm certainly willing to talk to people and check out dates and see what the situation would be and all of that. So, I mean, I have to be honest, I don't enjoy traveling as much as I used to, because it's different now than it was when I was first doing it. I mean, you know, when I was younger and when I was first doing this and would do a show, I mean, I could get to the airport within a half an hour and run to my gate and jump on the plane, and it's not like that anymore for many and obvious reasons, you know. So it's a whole different experience these days, and it can be draining, and, you know, you don't bounce back as quick as you used to and all that kind of jazz. But I would certainly be willing to have a conversation with anybody.
I would even go so as far as I think Sony just recently mentioned that they're coming out with a Venom movie. So I can imagine that there's going to be a lot more interest in that symbiote suit as well coming up. So definitely there's going to be a lot of tie-ins coming up in the next year.
Well, there's that. I can't believe it, but I read that Sony is currently pursuing, I don't know whether it's going to actually get produced or not, but a movie called Silver and Black with Silver Sable, which was a character that Tom DeFalco and I created. And the New Warriors is coming on TV, and we created the New Warriors and Night Thrasher, and he's going to be included in it along with, you know, far more contemporary characters. But it's going to be interesting these next few years, and we'll see what happens. But, you know, when Venom hits, believe me, it's going to be, you know, David Michelinie, and it's going to be Todd McFarlane, and yeah, we may get a little. I mean, when they did the black suit in the third movie, DeFalco and I did our share of interviews and stuff, but we'll see how it turns out. You know,
I actually did go on IMDb, and I saw those two as well. I went on there and I saw Silver and Black. Apparently, something's coming out in 2019, a film.
Working on a script now, and you never know with these projects. I mean, they could happen, they could not. They've been talking about a Sinister Six and a Venom movie for 10 years now. You know,
so. That's true.
All right, let's get into this. Let's start at the beginning, Ron, because you started talking about the warm memories we have from childhood. So when it comes to your biography and comic book history, take us back to the beginning and what your earliest memories were of comic books for you.
Well, I wish I could remember the number offhand, but I just recently, not all that long ago, purchased a copy of the first comic book I remember being around the house. I have a brother that's 3 years older, and there was a World's Finest comic that was around the house, and I don't have the copy in front of me, but it was a comic where Robin and Jimmy Olsen had faked their deaths, and Batman and Superman were very upset about it, and were standing over their graves, and Robin and Jimmy were hiding in the background, you know, going... And that was the first book I remember, the Kurt Swan cover, you know, the whole thing. So we came into it the traditional way through Superman, Batman, the 1960s. So I was born in 1960, so when the Batman series came out, I was, you know, 6, 7, 8 years old, and that's when I really started to get into comics and the artwork and all that kind of jazz. The comic I was just talking about, I believe, was like a 1964 comic. So I, you know, probably discovered it 4, 5, 6, you know, and really we were into those characters. In 1966, it was the Superman cartoon that I just loved on Saturday morning, and we discovered the Spider-Man cartoon in 67, and, you know, so I started getting into Marvel and Spider-Man in particular, and the Marvel superhero cartoons, Iron Man and all that, and was an avid comic reader up, you know, started when they were like 12 cents, and you could buy a lot for a few bucks, and I never really had an allowance, but my dad would pay for our comics, and he'd take us out on a Tuesday night, and we'd go to 3 or 4 different locations and with spinner racks and pick up our weekly haul of comics for a few bucks, and it was wonderful. I loved the artwork. I was a big fan of everybody from Kurt Swan and Al Plastino and Nick Carty to when I discovered the Romitas and the Buscemas, and of course Jack Kirby along the way there. And it's, you know, it's been an amazing thing. I was a huge, huge comics fan, and love the form and love the storytelling. I mean, these days when I sit at the studio and take a break, I have those, essential volumes, the black and white essential volumes. All over the place, and I flip through those and relive some of my memories. A place opened up pretty close to me, a comic shop moved from a different location into an area real close to me, and I started going through his. He has an enormous section of long boxes with back issues and stuff, and I started going through there and rebuying some of the stuff that I fondly remember from when I was a kid, and so I could have fresh copies of them and clean copies of them, and loving every minute of it. I still very fondly relate to the stuff that I grew up on, and that's the kind of stuff I enjoy doing. So there's not a lot of market for it these days. I have found the people I'm working for now, an outfit called Sit Comics, are very interested. He was a child of the 70s, the guy I'm working for, Darren Henry. And so I get to work on characters that have a little bit more of that sensibility, and I really, really enjoy that. So that's how it started. I was very directed from the age of 8. If you ask me what I wanted to do when I grow up, it was work for Marvel Comics and draw Spider-Man. I went to the last two years of high school. I went to a Votech, a commercial art class, and then I also went to 2 years at the Art Institute of Pittsburgh, where I kind of got away from my bottlenecking of only wanting to do comics and started to pay attention to other forms and other techniques and things like that that all just made my comics work better. Around graduation time, I was able to show samples to Jim Shooter, who was then editor-in-chief of Marvel Comics, who's a Pittsburgh native. He was doing a shop appearance. I showed him my stuff, sent it into Marvel. Didn't get an immediate response, but it was apparently put into a drawer of stuff that they intended to get around to at some point. And in the meantime, I got a job at a local animation studio, and I did storyboarding and design work for, and some in-betweening for a local animation studio for local and regional TV spots, commercials, animated commercials. And about a year into that, I got a call from Marvel, from Al Milgrom initially, and he handed the phone to Louise Jones, and they hired me to do a couple of Kesar fill-ins, and King Conan, and, you know, then it started. And I was doing that and the animation studio at the same time for a couple of years. And then in 84, 85, when they called me and offered me Spider-Man, which was, you know, based on the fact that Spider-Man had appeared in Kesar, which got me Marvel Team-Up, which ultimately they were willing to take a chance on me on Spider-Man, I quit the animation studio and went into comics full-time. So
that's incredible. That, I mean, nowadays it's you know, still the drawing Batman or Spider-Man are kind of like you've made it, and for you to go from doing some fill-ins to testing you out on Spider-Man to getting that gig, what was that like?
Now, in fairness, things did happen fast. I'm not going to say they didn't, but I was the regular artist on Kesar. Mm-hmm. I was the regular artist on Star Wars. I was the regular artist on Marvel Team-Up briefly before I was awarded the Spider-Man. So I did some dues paying. And very early on, they decided that what they liked was my storytelling.
Yeah.
So they were throwing jobs at me that I was just doing breakdowns on them. I wasn't doing full pencils. And I was still trying to develop a full pencil style when I was doing covers and things. But mostly I was doing these breakdowns. And Spider-Man was a situation where I was originally hired and I wanted to do full pencils on Spider-Man. But once Joe Rubenstein was in place as our regular anchor, he was happier if I was just doing breakdowns. He wanted to be more of a finisher. And Danny Fingeroth, the editor, said, no, I hired Ron to do full pencils. He's doing full pencils. But my attitude was, let's keep the anchor happy, you know, Joe is completely capable of handling breakdowns and doing a fantastic job, so I did breakdowns on Spider-Man, too. They were tighter breakdowns than I had been doing before, for the most part. But and these days, I'm pretty much full pencil. Working with Sal on Spider-Girl, things like that, working on what amazed me is working on Thor with Joe Sinnott, who can finish anybody's layouts. He was so faithful to my pencils that I would do breakdowns when I had to, but for the most part, I full penciled Thor and just loved working with Mr. Sinnott. Who wouldn't, for God's sakes? And so, I mean, for the most part, these days, almost everything I do is pretty much full pencils, but I certainly recognize that when deadlines call for it, you go to breakdowns and you count on your anchor a little bit more, you know.
Right. I have a question in regards to that, because I always look at the credits when I read those comics from the 80s, and I saw, you know, in your run of Spider-Man, even in John Romita Jr., what's the difference between breakdowns and finished art and then full pencils and inks? And just so the listeners can understand that.
Well, there's no pat answer to that. Breakdowns can be anything from very, very, very loose with very little detail on anything and the backgrounds, you know, not lined in at all, to something much tighter where you just don't fill in the blacks. And if there's a large black area, you just put tiny little X's, you know. So everybody has a different idea of what loose breakdowns are, what, you know, what layouts are, what breakdowns are, all that. I've done everything in the, you know, in the rainbow of what a breakdown is. I some jobs I've just done thumbnails for, and then other people take the thumbnails and blow them up to page size and trace them onto the boards, and then a different artist comes in and inks it. You know, I've done real solid breakdowns that are just like, if I talk about line character and things, you know, when an inker comes in, they will do thick thins, and when you do full pencils, you'll be more concerned with lighting and shadow work and doing thick thins on the line, putting a character to the line. A lot of what I did as breakdowns was the storytelling and all the drawing, but not being concerned with the character of the line. and shadow work and things like that. And I left that for the inker to put in if he felt it was necessary. So it unfortunately, there's no solid pat answer that applies to everybody with what those different credits mean. You know, it just doesn't. Tom DeFalco got very comfortable because we would co-plot a lot of things, and he co-plots with a lot of his illustrators, story, words, and pictures by Tom DeFalco and Ron Frenz, you know, and that had people, you know, confused where was Tom involved in the artwork, how much was I involved in the story, you know, things like that.
Right.
It can change from person to person and situation to situation. From issue to issue, it can change. It's one of those things where I've always seen what we do as more of a craft than an art form. And I don't really understand why there's too much fascination with how the sausage is made, to tell you the truth. Because it's all about the final product, which is a story.
Right.
Ideally, the people that worked on the story, from the editor to the letterer to the colorist to me to the writer, we should all disappear, and you should be more involved in what's happening with Peter or Mayday or, you know, Eric Masterson and Thor. You know, I've always really seen the industry and the craft as the final result and not the process. So
you've done a number of fantastic cover work. Do you prefer working on the covers or the sequential art?
They're different experiences. I enjoy them both immensely. I think if I was just doing covers, I'd probably get bored with it after a while. I was in a very rarefied atmosphere during the period of time I was doing a lot of covers, because Ralph Macchio was happy with the cover work I was doing on Thor. So he awarded me a stint on the Captain America covers and the Fantastic Four covers, which were both coming out of his office too, because he also liked what I would suggest as far as blurbs and copy, that you made them feel exciting and made them feel a little bit more like the 60s and 70s and things, and he was very appreciative of that. So he gave me a lot of free rein to produce some of those covers, you know, as long as the captions were indicated on the layouts that he approved, then he would let me, you know, pencil in the lettering and everything, and then we'd have production guys in the bullpen reproduce it in ink and everything. So I really enjoy doing the covers. I think the cover artist's biggest job is to, yeah, I don't care if it's the 478th time that the Human Torch has fought the Thing, your cover has to make it look like it's the first time. Your cover has to sell it, you know? You have to be, and for me, it's the first time I get to draw it, so it's easy for me to be excited about that, and it's easy for me to try to communicate that excitement. And it's always fun to see sometimes the plots. Sometimes they would send me, pages from the pencils. When I was doing Captain America, I would get to see the pencils by Kieran Dwyer, which were, you know, gorgeous. And occasionally Kieran would even do a real rough cover sketch of what he was thinking for the cover idea, and I would work off of that, you know, things like that. So I love doing pinups, and I love doing covers and everything, but my real attraction to the industry and what I really think I enjoy the most is the storytelling aspect of it and the acting aspect of it and the getting into the characters. And there's nothing more amazing than, you know, drawing with a pencil, and I still use pencils and boards and everything. I've never advanced to the computer stuff. But there's nothing more interesting to me than sitting down with a pencil and creating a scene off of somebody's plot or out of my own head and having it go through the process and be inked and lettered and colored and come out as a comic book and be able to create or spark an emotional response. That's all in the story, man. That's everything coming together to tell a story, to create the illusion of reality for people that they can actually get into a story and have an emotional reaction. That's amazing. That is so cool. That is such a privilege to be able to do that. You know, it really is.
There's something special. Yeah, go ahead, Mark.
No, I was going to say, and I completely agree. And I think even on the covers that you created, one in particular, the X Factor number 6. This is something that's sort of burned in my psyche forever.
I mean, which one was that? You have to remind me.
Apocalypse.
Oh, with Apocalypse's head in the center and them just being blown. Okay, yeah.
There's just something about the way you drew those figures. I mean, they just look like they're in absolute agony, and it kind of pulled me into that comic itself. And I don't know if you remember too much about creating that cover or what direction you were given, but do you recall how that went?
Well, I certainly didn't create, didn't design Apocalypse or anything. I was sent, I believe they were drawings by, interior pages by, I'm remembering Butch Geis. So I'm not sure if that was that particular issue or it might have been an issue before or something. But anyway, I was sent reference on Apocalypse, and usually what I would do, depending on how many ideas came to me, I would send between 2 and 6 thumbnail drawings of possible ideas. And they were mostly interested because they wanted to bring Apocalypse in as a big bad guy and everything. They were mostly interested in something symbolic to show that, you know, his power and his presence as a new big villain. So that was one of the sketches. They chose that sketch. And, I mean, almost everything I do has a root somewhere in something I saw as a reader, you know. Some people will say, well, there are no new ideas. And some people will say, so what you're saying is you copy everything. And I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is you're influenced by what went into your program. You know, you take all this stuff in. I'm sure you can find a cover from, you know, Marvel in the 60s and 70s that had that kind of feel to it and pulled something similar off, probably much better than I did. But I'm glad. I mean, if that cover made you pick up that book and buy it, that's what they're supposed to do. And I'm gratified that it had its effect. You know, that's one of the things these days, because with the way comics are marketed these days, nobody really cares about the covers anymore. The covers don't sell the books. For the most part, the books are pre-ordered, and they're even pre-ordered for the individual buyer as a subscription to a shop or something. So it's amazing how little they seem to worry about the cover selling the comic anymore. So it's a shame.
It seems a lot of days they give you just options of covers to buy, and people aren't – they're picking which picture they like as opposed to the cover that is telling them the story.
Well, most covers don't tell the story anymore. We went through a phase on Spider-Girl where it was explicit from editorial that, not from our individual editor, it came down from the top, that all the covers were supposed to be representative of the character but not representative of the specific story. And I found that ludicrous. But we adapted, and, you know, just to not to really toot my own horn, because I didn't agree with the edict from the top, but it came down from people working for and Joe Quesada at the time. And from what I understood, I never spoke to Joe personally about it, but from what I understood from my editor, that I was getting what he was trying to say more than some of the other people were, because I would do covers that, you know, for me, it put me into a mindset of, remember the old Archie comics where they had a separate gag on the cover that was not necessarily representative of what was inside, but it was, but it created, you almost told its own story, you know? And I would do shots of like Mayday running into an alley and opening her sweat jacket to show her costume and they were pinup covers, but they had some semblance of a story or a background thing, or said something about the character. And he was pleased with the ones I was doing because they had some sense of that to it. But as I say, I mean, as much as, you know, you respect your editors, I don't agree with that. I would much rather have a cover that represents what's inside the book that you're going to buy, you know. But either way, you do the best work you can with what you're given. It's really, you know, the editors and the publisher are your client, and you try to give them what they're asking for to the best of your ability. And hopefully if you do that, you end up with a 35-year career.
So. Do you have a favorite cover personally that you did that you're specifically proud of?
Oh, for God's sakes, guys. you know, if we talk about it long enough, I could probably start listing a few that I was really happy with, but it would be really hard for me to pick a favorite. I mean, for one reason, they're all my babies, you
right.
know. I mean, it's one of those things. There were some that, oh, let's see if I can pull one out of my ass. Because some of them, they get colored up, they get inked really well, they get colored up really well, and you go like, wow, that worked, you know, that kind of thing. And that was the other thing with Ralph Macchio. I would take reduction Xeroxes of my covers and color them with color pencil and send in, you know, color sketches of what I was thinking. And they started out doing something similar, but then after a while, what they started doing was just somebody would take my color sketches and code them back in the days of four-color comics, and they would code them to what those colors would be for the coding, and they would send those to the separators, and, you know, the covers were actually coming through completely as I intended. And so there was a run of Thor covers I'm very happy with. There was a run of Amazing Spider-Girl covers I was very happy with. And, you know, A-Next, because Tom DeFalco was the editor as well as the lead writer on the MC2 line at first, very briefly for like the first 6 months or so, I guess. He was also the editor that, you know, we had a lot of leeway there, and we're, you know, producing the best stuff we knew how to do. So there was some work there that I was real happy with. So, but boy, an individual issue. The Thunderstrike, and I can't tell you the number, but it was the one where I didn't even do the interior, but we lost Jock Jackson from Code Blue, and it was just a shot of Eric, the back of Eric holding Jock's body, and there was a nice spatter effect by Al Williamson in the background, and the figures were just colored red, and it was very stark, black, white, and red. Mm-hmm. You know, things like that stick in my head. You know, we did a couple of Thor covers that were monochromatic that I thought worked really well and popped off the racks. But again, that was when you were still trying to sell the book with the covers. And so quite often when I would use monochromatic covers, it was because when you look at those walls in these comic shops and it's just a sea of color,
right.
Sometimes the best thing you can do is just be red, popping out at
right.
people, you know, that kind of thing. And we used to do that every once in a while and try to get away with it.
Yeah. The one of yours that stands out to me, I want a T-shirt of it, is the one where the two Spider-Man costumes are pulling Peter apart, and it's not too much color on
yeah.
it. That one.
Yeah, that was terrific, too, because, again, the effect that I'm not even sure what Joe Rubenstein used. I think he might have used, like, a charcoal pencil or something, but to get that swirling effect, it's very effective. It's terrific, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, that was a good one. That was a good one. I've actually done a couple of recreations, and I experimented with, like, charcoal pencils and wax pencils and everything to try to get a similar effect, and I sort of kind of got it, but, that was a very effective cover. I agree with you. I like that one.
That was great.
So you tell me some covers, and I'll go, yeah, I like that one. You know.
I always liked the Thor Hulk one that you did as well.
That was nice and basic. There you go. Al Milgram did a great job on it. It colored up real nice with a white background. It pops right out at you. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, some of my favorite covers by other people. Romita did a run of covers on Spider-Man in the, like, the 60s. The numbers, this Amazing Spider-Man in the, like, you know, the issue numbers in the 60s. The one with Spidey, you see Spidey from the back and the giant Mephisto hands are coming in at him. and it has some Zippitone effect in the background and everything. And he used to do a lot with just like one or two figures on the cover that were like really powerful and really jumped out at you. And that's what a cover is supposed to do. You know, I mean, that's it. That's all a cover is supposed to do is go, hey! So you know, and then if you put some copy on it, you know, Tom DeFalco always felt that if you put a little bit of copy on that book and the image makes, he goes, hey, and then they take a minute to read the copy, then you got a chance of getting a hook into that person and they might pick up the book, you know. But again, things, they have different concerns these days as far as marketing and everything. So
now I'm gonna look at that Apocalypse cover and think he's saying, hey.
Every time we look at it.
Well, you know, it could, if Apocalypse does it, you got to listen. But
that's true.
I was blown away. I saw that they were doing some kind of a storyline with Apocalypse within the last year or so, and there was a run of covers by other artists that were kind of doing a pastiche on that original cover.
I saw that.
Yeah, and that was wild because, you know, it's not like they told me or anything. I just noticed a couple of them and I went, is that Deliberate? And then I even saw a couple of the guys even signed them after Friends and I went, wow, okay, that's kind of neat to be remembered, you know.
There were three covers actually after that.
They're remembering Apocalypse, not me, but that's nice. I'll take it.
So one of the things I really noticed, not only on the cover art, but on your interiors, you use a lot of, and maybe I don't know what the term is, but they're movement lines or sort of background lines that sort of demonstrate movement, as well as a lot of the, dots or similar to what people refer to as Kirby Crackle. Do you find that this is a bit of a trademark of yours?
No. No, I that is all part of a language that was established way before I got there. That I am a big fan of, and I think we make a mistake and kind of hamstring ourselves a little bit if we don't use them. And these days, a lot of the comics, to guys who have been reading comics for any period of time, a lot of the new stuff is beautifully illustrated, but it seems very static. It seems very still. Because we're not using that language of motion lines and impact marks and thought balloons and Kirby Crackle and things like that, you know, because it was just part of the language that was developed by men like by Jack Kirby and Will Eisner and guys who, you know, perfected the form and. It works.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes for a very dynamic storytelling. It makes for a response to these kinds of things. And that's what you're going for, you know. I mean, if using those kinds of things as graphic interpretations of speed or power or a punch or whatever it is, that's the only way we can compete with the films. I mean, I was just talking about this the other day with somebody. I was an idiot because, I'm an idiot for a lot of reasons, but in this particular case, when I saw the first Fantastic Four movie and the Human Torch was done with CGI, convincingly with CGI, right? I actually thought for a New York Minute, I actually thought that guys like Brian Hitch and Alex Ross were now out of work. Because now that we saw what the Human Torch would look like in real life, we wouldn't need these incredibly realistic illustrators to do that anymore. We could just go back to doing it the way Jack Kirby did it, with the little licks of flame and the lines to show, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I went, great, we don't have to worry about being photographic anymore because now they can go to the movies for that. We can go back to being graphic interpretations of these things. And, of course, I was completely wrong because the books still, to this day, want to be the movies. They want to look like storyboards for the movies. And they're using some fantastic illustrators, but I'm not seeing the kind of story. They look more like storyboards for movies than they do using the tools of what comics do best. And, you know, I'll be honest with you, it's my personal opinion, but comics, as far as using the tools available to them of storytelling and dynamics and figure work, and it, we're never better than Kirby at his peak in the 60s.
Yeah.
You know, that was a man who understood, and in fact, he developed most of the language for modern comics. And when I say language, I mean the graphic language of dynamic figure work and the human figure as a design element and showing power and showing energy literally and metaphorically in his stuff. He created some flat out and certainly developed it to a fine edge. And, you know, that was, to me, in my personal opinion, the best example of what comics can do effectively. As far as telling a story and grabbing an audience and affecting you and making you feel something with the writing. And those are the kinds of stories that I try to be a part of. Certainly when Tom DeFalco and I work together, that's the effect we're going for. And, you know, you want to involve your audience as best you can. Of course, you know, for the last several years, we have an entire audience of comic readers now that probably see that as old school or old hat, or, you know, everybody loves the comics they grew up on.
Yeah.
That's just a fact. Yeah. I mean, I'm never going to love any kind of a comic more than what I grew up on in the 60s and 70s. This is not going to happen. And so I completely expect that from the people that are reading comics today, you know?
Yeah.
I think you're absolutely right, and I think that's again why that sort of struck out to me so much, because I've been reading quite a few of the modern comics, and then I saw that and I said, wow, you know, it's almost like this is a different type of style that I missed, and instantly it sort of brought me back to childhood, you know, the lines and the Kirby crackle, and it really struck me. So,
well, and there was a time on Spider-Girl that I tried to avoid it a little bit more because, you know, we didn't want Spider-Girl to just be, we were in a very rarefied area with Spider-Girl because we were nostalgia for people that grew up on Spider-Man and liked the idea that he was in his 40s and had a teenage daughter and all that kind of stuff, right? But we also were getting a lot of young people who were relating to the Mayday character and were really enjoying, you know, that end of it. So I was trying to kind of please both camps as best I could. So you know how back in the day you would do those shock lines like crazy, you know, and if somebody was punching somebody in the face, you'd see a separate shock line right there between the fist and the face, right? And I was staying away from that in favor of maybe putting shock lines or shade lines in the overall background of the panel to show the impact, you know, and things like that, and trying to find other ways to kind of meet the new aesthetic halfway and still add the action and stuff. Because, like, one of the things that got brought over from manga was putting the speed lines in the background instead of having them connected to the character and separate from the background. You just kind of take the background and throw in all the speed lines in the background, and it's something right out of anime and right out of manga. And I've used that a few times and thought it worked pretty well, you know, especially if it's a nice big figure that you don't need to have anything else in the background for storytelling purposes, you know. So there are a lot of different ways to communicate motion, and I think if we don't use any of them, we're cheating, you know, it's kind of like, again, I think of comics as a craft. Like, you know, it can be a beautiful piece of art, but if it doesn't effectively tell a story, then it's not a good comic to me. You know, I mean, it might be a beautiful piece of art, but it's not a good comic. And it's like a belt can be a beautiful piece of leather craft, and it can be a work of art, but if it doesn't hold your pants up, then it's not a belt, you know? That's how I was indoctrinated into the industry. Those are the objective rules that I learned reading comics, and when I came into comics professionally, you know, those are the things that the objective standards that I held myself to. But over the last several years, comics have you know, it started at the end of the 80s, and it wasn't so big in the 90s, but then with the 2000s, it really started, where comics is an art form, okay? And comics is an expression, a personal expression for the artist that is doing the comic. So you can't say, well, you can't say he failed as a storyteller, because it's subjective.
Right.
And you can't say that he took too long to get to the point. And you can't say that, you know, that story was boring, because how dare you? It's art. It's subjective. He was expressing his self. And that's not how I see the business. That's not how I see the craft. So if that puts me in a position of kind of like being the dinosaur, so be it. But I think that is an intrinsic difference in how writers and illustrators approach the work now that is different from how we approached it, you know, in the 80s and such.
That's interesting, and it's an interesting point, because so many of the stories that they're recreating for movies and television come from a time that you're referring to, where that craft is there. They may update it for like a modern world where there's, you know, modern technology, but basically the Daredevil Netflix show is the Frank Miller comic book come to life in a lot of ways. And a lot of the things that we see in the Spider-Man movies are all the Stan Lee and Ditko and Romita stories that they're coming back with, right?
So for the most part, I would agree with you. Yeah, I mean, they update it with some of the newer characters like Winter Soldier and Yankee and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, I agree with what you're saying. Basically, yeah, because intrinsically, that, you know, until they. Well, like right now, we're all gearing up for Infinity War, which was, you know, that was the 80s.
So. Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
Or 90s or something. I don't know when it was. But.
Yeah. Well, I'm happy that you brought up Kirby. I wanted to ask you about him because he's obviously, in reading your Thor, it was an obvious influence of yours. But for me growing up, the Kirby images weren't the most appealing to me as a young person, or even a little bit later on. But now, as I'm becoming more well-read and well-versed in comic books, I go back to Kirby art, and I'm completely amazed by it. And I hear a lot of people have that experience. What is it about his work that initially you look at it and you think, oh, that's ugly, to later on saying, that's the greatest thing I've ever seen? Did you have that same experience?
First, let me say, I had exactly the same experience. I mean, I agree that a lot of people experience Kirby that way, and it's, I don't know. I can only speak for myself, but for me, when you first encounter Kirby, it's like, wow, what is this? I mean, and it really is in your face, literally and figuratively, and you can appreciate the visceral nature of it. You can appreciate the basicness, or, you know, how basic and simple it looks as far as the storytelling is clear and concise and tells you exactly what is going on. Now, as soon as you discover the Romitas and the Buscemas or the Neil Adams or whatever, you tend to go towards them because it looks more realistic. It's still dynamic, but it's realistic. And you don't necessarily immediately realize that, oh, these guys are all playing off of Kirby, though. You know, but when I was 7, 8, 9, and I would see John Buscema recreate a scene from a Kirby Fantastic Four, and I'd pull out the original Kirby in a reprint or whatever, and I would compare the two, Buscema all the way, right? You know, it's like, well, he really improved on that, you know, that kind of thing. But that's not the magic of Kirby. You know, the magic of Kirby is not drawing the human figure exactly the way it looks. I mean, and when you let go of that, when you realize that he is utilizing all of these visual tools so effectively to tell the story. I mean, the big thing for me was when I realized, and when you talk, I mean, there's no denying that we're all the sons and daughters of Jack Kirby in this industry. If you're in this industry, whoever, you know, even if you were never influenced directly by Jack Kirby, whoever you were influenced by was probably influenced by Jack Kirby. And if they weren't, whoever they were influenced by was influenced by Jack Kirby. So somewhere we all have Kirby in our DNA. There's no escaping it at all.
Yeah.
And I am a huge Jack Kirby fan and aficionado. But the Thor stuff was because I was doing Thor. In the same way that when I first came on Spider-Man, I was doing Ditko.
Right.
Because my feeling on such things is that if you are awarded a character like this that existed before you got there and will exist after you're gone, your job is not to do, you know, my job is not to do Ron Frenz's Thor or Ron Frenz's Spider-Man. My job is to make sure that character is still ticking when I get off the book.
Right.
You know, and what has always kind of annoyed me as a fan is this idea that sometimes the next person's version of a character is only based on the person right before him, and it became, you know, the game Telephone, where one person tells the person a story, and then as it goes from person to person, it gets so bizarre and ridiculous and mistranslated and everything that, you know, I'll give you a couple of quick examples. Storm had this white costume on the Fox X-Men cartoon. She never meant to have a white costume. That was a black costume when it was designed by Mark Silvestri. It was a black costume that had a lot of blacks on it, and they decided, which I thought was genius, instead of putting blue on it or gray on it to show that it was black, they let the blacks carry it, and they let the highlights stay white. Okay?
Wow.
But over a series of different artists drawing it, you started to lose the blacks. It's like you can find pictures of the Panther that look like the Blue Panther. Another example is the Beast. The Beast, when he first became, you know, when he went from the X-Men version to the Hairy Beast version, he was gray, okay? And then a few issues in, they decided they wanted something with a little more pop. His fur went black, okay? He was never blue. Nobody ever said, oh, his fur went from black to blue. They just stopped putting so much black on him. And a writer came along and said, well, what color's the Beast? Well, he's not black. He's blue. Look, he's obviously blue. And he started talking about his blue fur, and suddenly you got a blue character. But that's, you know, so those games of telephone used to frustrate the crap out of me when I was a fan. And to avoid that, when I work on a character, I like to go back to the first people that did that character. Spider-Man, obviously, that's Ditko. With Thor, obviously, that's Kirby. And what you're looking for is what makes that character unique from all the other characters. You know, you want to make sure that Spider-Man doesn't stand like Superman, or he doesn't stand like Batman. He does, you know, you don't want him to stand like Captain America. You want him to stand like Spider-Man. You want him to be sure that he is uniquely himself in every situation. That's why you go back and you study them, their original roots. And that's what I did. I mean, I recently on my Facebook page, somebody asked me, well, why are your first couple of Thor jobs very, you know, your regular style, very Buscema, you know, very not Kirby? And then once you got into the series a few issues, that's when you find your Kirby. Well, it's because, simply it was because when we got hired on Thor, we did the two fill-ins, and then we kind of got hired on Thor. It was a surprise. It was an incredibly happy surprise, but it was kind of a surprise. I didn't have a lot of prep time to go back and look at original Thor stories. And when I did and started appreciating the power and the, you know, Kirby really did gods that looked like gods. They stood like gods. Their attitudes in their faces and the way their heads were cocked and everything, just looked like gods. And I was doing my studying on the fly. With Spider-Man, you know, I had time with Marvel Team-Up and with, you know, the appearances in Kesar and everything. If you look at the appearances in Kesar, I really wasn't doing any research at that point. That was Ron Frenz just doing Spider-Man as he existed at that time. You know, I mean, I'm influenced by Sal Buscema and John Buscema and guys like that. But, you know, it was when I got on the strip and I was on Team Up, I started looking at the Ditko and looking how Spider-Man's supposed to move and who is he, you know, individually as a character and stuff. So I was more prepped when I started on Spider-Man to really have, I had already started my study of Ditko. But you see, that's the thing too. You also move out of that. I mean, in, you know, people don't recognize that as much because they remember what they remember about your stuff, and you don't want to talk them out of that because if it's something they enjoyed, that's great. But if you look at my run of Spider-Man, the Ditko tends to start to fade, you know, as we got into past the black costume and we got out of the alien costume stuff and we were introducing Silver Sable and we were, you know, doing some of the stuff in the last year that we were on the title, I really started to assert my own natural style and all that kind of stuff. And the same happened with Thor. When we got to the Eric Masterson stuff, we were kind of blazing new ground. I didn't feel that it didn't feel right to have Eric's Thor look at all Kirby.
Right.
Because he wasn't that guy. He didn't move like that guy. He didn't fight like that guy. So I just decided to kind of put the Kirby behind me and use my own style as it is, you know, which is, again, you know, it's based on other people that I love and have been influenced by. But, you know, kind of went with my more natural Sal, John Buscema type style, Romita type style, you know. And so in both cases, that study is invaluable in learning about the character, and you also hopefully are learning some of their storytelling techniques and using them effectively, and it improves your own work 110%. But, you know, it's not something that I stick with. I mean, right now I only pull out Kirby if somebody specifically asks me to. You know, if I'm called to do a pinup to recreate a Kirby scene, or if somebody asks for a commission and they specifically ask for it in a Kirby style, I will do it in a Kirby style. But otherwise, it's, you know, you get me for what it's worth. You know.
Well, your style
on your run for Thunderstrike. I'm a huge fan of weapons, and I thought did you actually create that mace design?
Yes.
Or Masters?
Well, I had some help.
Okay.
I was playing with the idea, and I came up with the triangle. I liked the idea of the rounded triangle as a weapon. And I had the rounded triangle and the cap. And I actually just recently on my Facebook page, I posted one of the early sketches I did with the cap, and I had a couple of bolts in the cap. And, you know, so that was, we were working off of that. And it was actually, we were looking for something to make it more distinct. And at one point, like Tom DeFalco suggested, well, what if we look at it from the side? What if it has like a lightning motif? And I drew up some sketches and I went, you know, Tom, that looks a lot like a meat tenderizer is what that looks like. I mean, I'm not sure that's a great idea, but I'm not sure that's going to work for us. It was Pat Olive. At the time, I was sharing studio space with Pat Olive, who is now knocking them dead on Rough Riders and things like that, and worked on Spider-Girl and on all kinds of great, great stuff. But he's a fantastic illustrator. He was the one that suggested taking one side of the triangle and putting the strike plate on it, you know, recreating the strike plate from Mjolnir on the one side. And I went, God, that's genius. That just works so great. So, and that opened up, you know, I took this, the bolts out of the cap and put the T on it, and boom, we had what we were looking for. I think it was always part of the original idea. You know, I'm not sure now if the chain was always part of the original idea or not. I mean, I remember going into New York. I mean, Pat came up with the strike plate, but I remember going into New York and meeting with Ralph Macchio and Tom DeFalco, and I think Mike Rockwitz was there. He was the colorist, our colorist at the time. So I you know, and we met with these guys, and we all kind of hacked it out and made suggestions and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, we'd all have to get some measure of credit for what was finally produced. But you know, it's really cool. I've actually seen a few online where people have built some Mjolnirs and stuff. Thunderstrikes. I have the best one. A buddy of mine who worked in special effects for years and actually helped design like Disneyland Japan and things like that. I built a cardboard Thunderstrike with the proper dimensions and all this kind of stuff, and I sent it to him because he was asking me if I was interested in this, and he made me several Thunderstrikes, painted them up real nice, all this kind of stuff, real chain on the handle, you know, the whole bit. And he goes, "Well, here's a question," and he wasn't sure I was going to get what he was asking. He says, "Do you want them the size they would be, or do you want them proportionate to you?" And I said, "Oh, I understand exactly what you're saying, because when Eric becomes Thunderstrike, he's you know like 6'5" or 7 foot." And I said, "I want them actual size, man."
Yes.
So that's what they are. And they're actually heavy. I mean, they're made for, you know, they're cast.
Oh, wow.
But the chain itself makes it pretty heavy. Tom DeFalco's got one in his home. I've got one, and I got a couple of, you know, stunt ones that, you know, didn't come out quite as nice and everything, but I have one over my studio right now, and it's one of my prized possessions because he nailed it. I mean, and believe me, when we came back and did the Thunderstrike miniseries a few years back with Kevin, I was even better at drawing the mace because I had it right in front of me. So it was kind of cool to be able to look right at it, and it helped with lighting and things like that. You know,
please take a picture of that. I want to see that.
Yeah,
you know, at some point I got to do that. I got to take a picture and put it up on Facebook because it really was bizarre and cool to see it come to life. It really was.
Great. So I want to ask you, you obviously have a great working partnership with Tom DeFalco. And you guys had to take over runs on the popular titles like Thor and Amazing Spider-Man after Roger Stern and John Romita and then Walter Simonson. How did you guys handle that pressure to take over those titles and have memorable runs on both of them?
It's a fair question, but there's really not all that interesting of an answer. I mean, I followed Walt on Star Wars. But that was something where, you know, I was brought in to do the storytelling because Tom Palmer was in place as the finisher and the look of the book. So, you know, but that was very intimidating then. But you're right. You come onto a book, Spider-Man is going along great. Roger Stern is, Roger's work is some of the best stuff ever done on Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Bar none. He's also the greatest guy you're ever going to meet, too. But he really nailed Peter Parker. He handled the character incredibly well. He's probably, X to the original Stan stuff, he's probably my favorite.
Yeah, a lot of people say that.
And, well, DeFalco says it, too, because DeFalco's the guy that hired him. And I guess the easiest way to, especially in the Spider-Man case, is we only thought we were going to be there for a little while. Okay. So when you talk about handling the pressure, DeFalco was brought in to script over two of Roger's plots, and I only thought I was going to be on for 6 issues while Romita Jr. went off and got X-Men up and running, and then he was going to come back and do X-Men and Amazing Spider-Man. But Danny Fingeroth ended up being happy enough with our work, and Romita Jr. was happy enough on X-Men that he gave Fingeroth a nod to just make us permanent. So first time I met John Romita Jr., I thanked him for my run on Spider-Man. So, but as we were, you know, getting in and getting settled, it really was just mostly a case of do the best work you can. All you can do is the best you can do. I mean, we both were big Spider-Man fans. Tom had just come off a stint of editing the book. He knew the character inside and out. I was a huge Spider-Man fan growing up. So we would have long conversations on the phone about who Peter Parker is and how we see the character. And the stories would just fortunately kind of grow out of those conversations. So you just, in any situation like that, all you can do is the best you can do. I think DeFalco and I benefit greatly from the fact that we love these characters and we love the medium. And I think if you're having fun, it can't help but come through on the page.
Yeah.
I don't get that a lot necessarily with current comics, but there are certain comics that I can read that just, you feel like you're part of the storytelling process. You know, these guys look like they were having fun. And I think we benefit from the fact that I think a lot of people, when they read our stuff, think these guys must be having fun because the story itself is fun.
Yeah.
We have genuine affection for the characters. And I think that comes through on the page. With Thor following Walt, there was no way we were going to be able to do Walt. Walt's relationship with the original Norse myths is something very specific. And even if we had sat and read the original myths and studied and crammed and read all the original myths, our relationship to those myths would not have been the same as Walt's.
Yeah.
So we felt from day one that trying to do Walt would have been a disaster.
Yeah.
Which is one of the reasons where we just did, let's do what we can do. And we'll see, just see how it goes, you know. Our experience, as much as we both enjoyed Walt's run, our experience was Lee and Kirby and Buscema and all those guys. And we just did the best we could. Again, you know, I have a lot of respect when you come on a book like that, like with my 251, with my first Spider-Man issue, if you look at it closely with an eye towards the storytelling, it blew me away one time because Roger Stern actually pointed it out to me. He actually caught it, and nobody else has ever mentioned it to me, is that the first half of the issue, I tried to emulate Romita Jr.'s type of storytelling. With the way he would do panel arrangements and the way he would transmit information and everything, and then about halfway I just decided, you know, that was my plan, was to kind of ease the audience in to the issues with what they were used to, and then the second half of it I kind of went 4-panel pages and 6-panel pages and kind of embraced my Ditko and my own storytelling style. And Roger at one point said, you know, I really like the way you did that. And I went, oh my God, you actually caught that. And that's Roger. You know, he's amazing. But I'm not even sure DeFalco knew I was doing that, to tell you the God's honest truth. But, you know, in both cases, the people we were replacing were just so fantastic and so individual in what they were able to do and what they were able to accomplish, that, you know, trying to emulate them was asking for failure. So you can really only do what you can do. You know, you have to kind of take the character and do him as you understand him from the history of the character, you know. But Walt's stuff was so specific and quite frankly so different from the rest of the history of the character.
Yeah.
That it, I don't think anybody else could have faked Walt. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no. There was no way to ease into, like, make that transition from his style.
Yeah. So, I mean, so my first few issues, I wanted to get to Asgard. I wanted to reestablish Kirby's Asgard. I wanted to reestablish the Warriors 3 as I related to them. And, you know, we did. We got rid of the beard real quick all kinds of things like that. We definitely let people know in a respectful way that, you know, Walt's not here anymore. What are you going to do? You know,
right.
And believe me, I was doing convention appearances at the time, where there was one time in particular, this guy a couple of rows back, and people were standing around the table, and there was a guy a couple of rows back, and he said, when's Walt coming back? And the guy in front of him went, he's the new regular guy. I mean, Walt's gone, he's the new regular guy. And the guy went, oh, hey, I know. When's Walt coming back?
Oh, wow.
And I said, dude, I don't know what to tell you, man. I'm sorry if you don't like what we're doing, but, you know, you almost wanted to say, Walt left because of your attitude. So you cost everybody Walt. I hope you're happy. But that's the thing. I mean, Walt's another guy where, I mean, his work is so unique and so specific that you can only do what you can do. You know, I mean, it's, You know, what's interesting is when people talk about Walt's run, they don't talk about the couple of years he did with Sal on the art, you know,
yeah.
because that was Walt, too. And they were really cool stories, too, you know. But when they talk about collecting Walt's run, it's always just the stuff he penciled and wrote himself, you know. So, and I followed all of that. I loved it. I thought it was wonderful.
Speaking of great stuff, I have to say, with all the wonderful Spider-Man stories that are out there, I mean, all the different books and titles and writers and artists, you may have penciled the best one with The Kid Who Collected Spider-Man. I mean, I know it was a short story at the end of 248, but I think that's the one that will always be remembered fondly by Spider-Man fans. What was that like to work on that book?
It was a gift. It's got to be a very rare, wonderful thing that something I did that long ago is still something I'm so proud of. Talking about Roger Stern, I mean, the guy is just amazing. And, his version of that was, you know, he woke up one morning and had the idea in his head, and he spent a day at the Marvel offices telling the story to people going, did I read that somewhere? Was that an old Superman story or something? You know, that kind of thing. And he couldn't come up with anywhere you might have seen it or read it or anything, so he put it on paper. And it was turned in as an 11-page story, and Tom bought it and wasn't sure whether he was going to put it in an annual or whatever it was. But, Assistant Editors Month came around, they decided that would be an opportunity to slot it, to make it special, and it wasn't decided that DeFalco, that was during the transition between DeFalco and Danny Fingeroth as editor on Spider-Man, and DeFalco was planning on giving me the kid so Romita Jr. could wrap up the story from the prior issue, but he wasn't sure what Danny was going to do. He said Danny's going to make the final call because he's the new editor on Spider-Man, so if I hear anything, I'll let you know, but you should be hearing from Danny one way or the other. And thankfully, Danny decided not to overrule Tom, and gave me the kid, and, I mean, you read the story, you read the plot, it just ripped your heart out there, you know, I mean, it's an amazing story, and it, the fact that it also includes Spidey's origin in a very unique way,
yeah,
it makes it like the perfect little 11-page story to kind of show people what comics can do, you know, because this is the perfect example of what I was talking about before, about you take a flat piece of board and you take a pencil and you draw images on it, and a writer writes dialogue, and it's lettered and it's colored and it's printed and it comes out on pulp paper, and it makes you feel something.
Yeah.
And it's an amazing thing to be a part of. I don't know what else to say about it. I'm very humbled to be a part of that story.
Yeah, that one will live on forever.
Sure.
And that was one of the reasons I embraced Ditko so much on that particular story, was because Spider-Man doesn't do a lot of spidery stuff. He has to be Spider-Man just standing there in his suit.
Yeah.
You know? And the funny thing about it is, you know, since that was all... Because I wasn't the first guy to be doing Ditko. I mean, Buckler on Spectacular Spider-Man, on Peter Parker Spider-Man, was cribbing some Ditko and doing some Ditko positions and all that kind of stuff and bringing some Ditko into it. So when I did The Kid Who Collects, it wasn't the first time that somebody was doing Ditko. I went a little further back on Ditko. I made him a little thinner and wanted him standing a certain way and all that kind of jazz. And I was also doing some of the reverse webbing. And at the time, because this was pre-McFarlane, this was pre... you know, getting too fancy with Spider-Man type shit. You know, Romita's was the model, no doubt about it. And Danny Fingeroth, when I was penciling that and sending those pencils in, Danny was a little uncomfortable with, you know, I was drawing Spider-Man's neck thinner, and I was, you know, drawing the reverse webbing, and he recognized that it was Ditko-ish, but he wasn't so sure that he shouldn't have it fixed in the inking. Mm. And to his I will say to his credit, because, you know, it's his prerogative, but he decided not to have it changed, and Austin just knocked it out of the park. My God, he made me look so good on that, it was ridiculous.
Wow.
But everything worked on that. The production guys getting the the torn areas of the newspaper and putting in the fake ads. Everybody knocked it out of the park on that. That's a rare thing. Because the production people, the coloring, everything was just 100% on that piece of work. So you can't feel anything but lucky when it all comes together like that. You know?
It's great.
I'd actually just recently read that the run on Spider-Girl was the longest running book from Marvel with the lead female character, which is fantastic. I mean, what do you think about that character that people were just so attracted to?
It was the legacy nature of the character. I mean, the smartest thing we did with Spider-Girl was making her the daughter of Peter Parker. And Pete was very much a character. So, you know, I think readers enjoyed Mayday as a character because we were very centered on making her equal parts Mary Jane and Pete, and those are two of the more popular characters in comics. But the fact that Pete and Mary Jane were a part of the strip, the fact that, again, I think that there was nothing in Spider-Girl, there was nothing in the MC2 universe that didn't show an incredible affection for the Marvel universe. And it was a very upbeat extension of the Marvel universe. You know, Tom and I grew up on the original Trek. You know, I mean, we were sick and tired of dark futures where the corporate overlords have taken over and we've survived the nuclear war and all this bullshit. I mean, we actually created a future. And there aren't near enough of them. We actually created a future where this generation of superheroes actually did what they set out to do and made the world a better place to live in. And in that world, if you are gifted with a special ability, it's not a bizarre thing to go, you know, I'd like to do what those guys did. I would like to contribute the way those guys did, and I would like to put on a goofy costume and stand up for the little guy. And that was the MC2 in a nutshell, you know.
Right.
It was the next generation of people who were inspired by the Marvel Universe, and it was, you know, so it felt to us like a very logical extension of that, you know, because we grew up in a Marvel universe where it wasn't about the first two pages of a story or the Brooklyn Bridge being blown up at rush hour and thousands of people are killed and the good guys have to go beat the hell out of the bad guys for doing it. We grew up in a world where the Avengers stopped that from happening. The point of the story is you stop the bad guy from blowing up the Brooklyn Bridge at rush hour.
Stop Galactus from eating
and Earth. Save those thousands and thousands of people. That's the point. And comics, to a degree, comics have lost that. I remember, you know, I don't want to get too heavy here, but I remember having conversations with comic fans after 9/11, and comic fans were, you know, saying, boy, I wish Superman was real because then he could go over there and he could kick their asses for this. And it's like, dude, I wish Superman were real because he could have stopped the planes from going into the fucking towers.
Yeah.
Pardon my French.
Exactly. Yeah.
But that, you know, it shows this weird, I don't know, shift in equilibrium about how we see these characters, how we see wish fulfillment, you know? And because for me, you know, I get, one time I got so choked up because it was in the era of Wolverine and all these characters where you would ask a kid, why do you like Wolverine? Because he kills people, you know, and he's brutal and he's mean. And it's like, come on, you're eight. You don't even know what that means, do you? But the one time during the height of the anti-hero and all this kind of stuff, I saw some documentary where there's this little girl dressed as Wonder Woman, and they said, why do you like Wonder Woman? And she said, because she saves people. And I could barely contain myself.
Yeah.
Because that's it, man. You know, that's one of the things that the Avengers movies do right. Even if it's just lip service, the Avengers movies do it right, and they lost it in Man of Steel, and to a lesser degree, in Batman v Superman. I mean, they made some corrections in Batman v Superman, but in both the Avengers movies, Captain America's issue, as he's giving orders to the Avengers, is getting the civilians out.
Right.
You know, and that is necessary. That is what these guys are supposed to be there for. You know, everybody used to get so bored with the fact that Len Wein would do these Spider-Man stories where, but almost like every Spider-Man story seems the same. First couple of pages, he saves somebody, and then the story starts. Well, that's Len Wein keeping his eye on the prize. You know, because if Spider-Man doesn't save somebody in the course of the story, you haven't told a very good Spider-Man story. I don't care if it's five panels where he saves a window washer from falling to his death, he should be saving somebody.
Yeah. That's the whole point of the character. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and so losing that in favor of a world where everybody's a freaking superhero and everybody's got a chip on their shoulder and everybody wants to beat the hell out of everybody else makes me crazy.
Yeah, it's damage control now, it seems, where there's things that happen as damage control, but that feeling of I can save people, so let me do it, is gone.
Yeah. Well, that was one of the things that in the Thunderstrike miniseries, Tom threw it in at the end, because we were dealing with Kevin's 616 Kevin, not MC2 Kevin, his attitude about superheroes. And since he had lost his dad to superheroing, he saw them as glory hounds and, you know, all this kind of stuff. We were trying to make a case for how the people on the street see these guys. And much like what they did in the Civil War movie, you know. And one of the things that he was shocked softened by, as far as his attitude about superheroes, was at the end, we showed them helping with the cleanup.
Yeah.
After Mangog has wrecked a couple of blocks of city. And Tom used it as an opportunity, as a tribute, used it as an opportunity to mention damage control. And that when they can, they like to help out. You know, that kind of thing. Which is another thing in Avengers, second Avengers, that they made a point about with the Maria Stark Foundation going in after the fact and helping with cleanup and repair and all that kind of stuff, too. You know, and that needs to be a part of what these characters do. I mean, the idea that somebody decided it was an interesting adult take on superheroes that, one, they get off somehow sexually by beating the hell out of other people. Thank you, Frank Miller.
Yeah.
And two, that they don't care, that they get so caught up in their battles that they don't care about the damage to property and everything, really dismays me, because that's not what these characters are about. I wish there had been one scene, one line in Man of Steel where Superman tries to take the fight away from people.
Yes.
And even if he didn't succeed, try. They did, again, in Age of Ultron, Iron Man tries to take the Hulk out of the city. He doesn't succeed, but he tried.
Right.
To move the fight away from people.
Yeah,
and that's, you know, it's storytelling, guys. Come on.
Yeah.
Think about this kind of stuff.
It's very interesting that you're saying this, because I got to ask, the catalyst for the Civil War was the accident with the New Warriors. And it just seems like when you're saying this, you know, or the New Warriors went in, obviously they didn't mean to cause, you know, the accident, but they, you know, really sort of made everybody sort of stand back and say, hey, wait a second here, right?
Which makes sense, sure.
Right. So what did you feel about, you know, how that was used, or how the New Warriors were used to kick off that whole in that particular way?
I didn't really relate to it personally much, because by at that point, you know, several other teams had handled the New Warriors and things like that. So there wasn't that kind of a response from me at all. And I got to say up front, full disclosure, I did not read the Civil War. I was aware on the periphery of how it was being handled and things. And I had some discussions with people about which side Iron Man and Captain America were taking, and isn't that right? You know, that kind of thing. I mean, I completely bought it in the movie. you know, that I was on board with both characters and why they were making the decisions they were making. But since I didn't read every issue of Civil War, and since I really don't know what things were covered in dialogue and what things weren't covered in dialogue and all that kind of stuff, I really hesitate to say too much about it, to tell you the truth. But you let go of these characters at some point, you know. I mean, some less than others. But New Warriors, I mean, for God's sakes, we did them in Thor. We designed, I designed a couple of crappy costumes that thankfully Mark Bagley redesigned almost immediately. And what Fabian and Fabian Nicieza and Mark Bagley did on that book was, you know, uniquely, that's the New Warriors. No doubt about it. And so I, you know, that was easy to let go of, you know, because Spider-Girl would be a lot harder. Thunderstrike would, of course, be a lot harder, you know, that kind of thing. But you know, by the time they got around to the Civil War and how they were using, I mean, a lot of our characters have been abused. I mean, hell, in Spider-Verse, Mayday was sorely abused.
Right.
And it is what it is, you know. I mean, you have to keep reminding yourself these aren't your characters. They're Marvel's characters. They will do with them what they will. And I may never get another crack at Mayday. If I do, that would be fantastic, and maybe we'll have something to say about it. But if we never get another crack at her, then that's, as my partner and unindicted co-conspirator Tom DeFalco is known to say, that's the biz, you know?
So I was going through, by the way, I've been loving your Facebook posts, by the way.
Oh, thank you, man. I wasn't sure whether you guys were aware of them. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I follow them. Especially a lot of the commission work that you've been putting up.
Yeah.
So I was scrolling through my Facebook feed, and this picture of Conan comes up.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I think it was one you did a couple of weeks back, and you put a little blurb about how you haven't, addressed this character in a while. And I didn't realize that you had worked on King Conan. And Eric will tell you, and he's probably just shaking his head right now because I'm a huge Conan fan. And anybody that I get to talk to that has worked on Conan, I got to talk about Conan.
Okay.
So I don't know if you remember working too much on that book, or if you were a big Robert E. Howard fan, or like what was your mindset sort of going into doing that book?
Well, that was one of those jobs that luckily I was only doing breakdowns on. God, I'm even trying to remember who wrote this. Who wrote the story?
Because
it was just that one issue of King Conan, and it was the regular
like the earlier ones. I think it was like number 12.
Yeah, it was fairly early in the run,
yeah.
But I can't. Oh God, I can't even remember who wrote it. You know what? I'm going to get up and I'm going to go look because I am not going to have this happen. But I had read some of the novels. And, you know, I got into Conan even before John Buscema, even though I'm such a big John Buscema fan. I read all the Barry Smith stuff and really liked what Roy was doing with the character and all that kind of stuff. But I was a huge fan that way, and it did make me want to go and read some of the novels and everything. So, well, as I came into the King Conan story, I was working off of the stuff that Buscema had done before. Doug Mensch,
okay.
Yeah, it was Doug Mensch, and Ricardo Viamonte did the finishes on it. But, you know, I just recently, because of the Facebook page, was, you know, I've been looking through old Xeroxes and going through old boxes and stuff, and I was actually shocked to see how open my breakdowns were for this job. I mean, again, I was, you know, I was drawing the figures, and I was drawing facial expressions, but I wasn't putting in any shadow. I was barely indicating backgrounds and things like that. And Rick Viamonte came in and did a wonderful, wonderful job with it. But it's a great character. I mean, he's one of those characters that has that mystique that, you know, you love to get a chance to take a shot at, you know. And when I saw Buscema's version as opposed to Barry Smith's version,
right,
it did bring a whole different, it was that much closer to the Frazetta paintings and such. And especially the one where he's on Thack's back, that one painting that Frazetta did. Was always Conan to me, and Buscema really seemed to be nailing that. And so it was a lot of fun. I they actually offered me King Conan as a regular gig, but they were oversized stories, right? And right. It scared me because I was working at the animation studio. So I turned it down. And believe me, it scared me. It scared the hell out of me to turn it down. And then a couple of months later, they offered me Kesar as a regular gig.
Right.
And I always loved Kesar, but, you know, I took it because I was afraid they'd stop offering things if I didn't take something. And at least Kesar was going to be standard 22-page stories, you know, that kind of thing. So, I do remember at one point saying, geez, I almost wish I would have taken King Conan instead, because it would have been fun to do Conan. And the only reason I say that is because as much as I loved Kesar and as much as I loved what Bruce Jones was doing, it wasn't the Kesar that I grew up on. You know, I was a constant pain to Louise Jones, now Louise Simonson, when she was editing Kesar, because I was constantly trying to interject elements of the original Kesar stories. You know, there was one where he reverts and goes savage to kill this one monster. And I said, well, you know what he should be saying? And I was putting it in the liner notes, and I had phone conversations with her where I'm going, you know what he should be saying, Louise, is stronger than the mastodon, stronger than the giant boar, mightiest Kesar, Lord of the Jungle. That was his thing, you know. Right. And she goes, Ron, darling, nobody cares. And I'm like, but Louise, you know, that kind of thing. And I was always on them to tell me. I wanted to see the story how that Kesar turned into this Kesar. You know, and she goes, no, Ron, I don't think anybody cares about that. And I said, okay. But I mean, one of the things that drove me crazy, and I didn't have any say in the matter, but there was a scene where Shana was telling Peter Parker how she, you know, how her relationship with Kesar started. And there's a scene where Kesar backhands her, and Peter goes, he hit you? And she said, yeah, all gorillas hit their mates.
Wow.
And I went apeshit.
Wow.
Because I actually called Louise, and I wasn't angry with her or anything, but I called her and I said, Louise, he's not an ape man. He's a feral child. He was raised by Zabu. And she goes, Ron, are we going to have this conversation again? But he's not Tarzan. He's not an ape. So that used to drive me crazy. I can be the anal retentive fan geek when it's brought out in me, you know? Danny Fingeroth used to talk about that all the time. Danny Fingeroth used to always tell me on conference calls, Ron, you are the biggest geek in the room. And I'm going, okay, fine, but why doesn't somebody listen to me?
That's an honor.
Right, now the geeks run the world.
There you go, see? But, I wish I had more specifics to tell you about the Conan job, but, you know, at some point on Facebook, I might even run some of the Xeroxes, and you'll be shocked at how little I was contributing to the final artwork, you know? So, but it was cool, and I got to design that demon with the ram horns and all that kind of stuff, and that was cool, you know? So.
Nice.
You get your Conan fix there, Martin.
I did.
Oh, man, it's a great character. It's one of the things that I have around my desk at the office. I finally, after years of not knowing it existed, I found out about that Roy Thomas and John Buscema had done this miniseries, Death Covered in Gold, this three-issue miniseries that was, you know, Buscema inking himself, one of the last projects he would have worked on. But I didn't even know it existed, and I had to go out and finally find it and got to read a new Roy Thomas, John Buscema Conan story after years and years, you know.
I don't think I've seen that one.
it's a cool story. It's basic stuff. I mean, it's a really good, solid Roy Thomas, John Buscema Conan story. So if you haven't seen it, yeah, it's still out there.
Okay.
I had the same experience when I was buying the bound volumes, the new books that somebody's putting out of the Spider-Man newspaper strip. And I bought the first couple of those, the black and white ones. And, you know, I was saying to Tom DeFalco, he says, do you have any plans for tonight? I said, yeah, I have plans for tonight. I'm going to go home, and I'm going to read a Stan Lee, John Romita Spider-Man story that I've never seen before. and it's going to be great.
See, those plans sound amazing to me.
Yeah, me too. That sounds like the perfect night.
Oh, it was ridiculous. I was like a kid in a candy store because, you know, that those guys just, they're the masters. They know what they're doing, you know.
I got to ask you about one more thing. Sorry, Eric.
No, go for it.
So I did, like I mentioned before, I did go on IMDb. And I saw like a couple of things that had your name to it, which were the Silver and Black and the New Warriors TV show. But the other thing I saw in there was some credits on Creepshow 1 and 2.
Yep.
So you were working as a part of the art department for that?
I was. That actually involved because it was a, for God's sakes, the gentleman who directed it. Come on, and we just lost him.
George Romero.
George Romero. It was a George Romero production. He's an old Pittsburgh guy, and he hires local talent whenever possible. So the animation studio that I worked at that did local and regional TV commercials were hired to do the animated spots in the first Creepshow and the second Creepshow. Now, when we did the first Creepshow, I was working there as an animation assistant. And I did very little other artwork. I did some of the artwork that's used in the opening titles, and
cool.
And I did a couple of insert things. They actually got one of the guys that actually worked for EC to Cayman, I believe his name was. They got him to do the actual fade in and fade out pages, but there were they hadn't come up with the idea yet of the creep hosting. So I did a couple of insert shots of the creep on some of the pages. On the second one, I was no longer a full-time employee of the animation studio, but they were looking for somebody to do the fade-in, fade-out pages. So on Creepshow 2, I actually did the pencils and inks on the pages that fade in and fade out from the live action.
Oh, wow. Yeah,
and,
I really like those movies. That's why.
Yeah, but on the first one, all the animation where the guy throws the book out the window and then the creep flies out and points to the comic in the garbage can and all that kind of stuff. I was the animation assistant on that, and did the in-betweening on that and everything. And we brought in a crew for it and all that stuff. I didn't have anything to do with the animation in the second one. There was actually considerably more animation in the second one. And, I was there with the crew and hung out with them and all that kind of stuff, but, I wasn't directly involved in any of the animation, mostly in the pages during the fade-ins and fade-outs. So, and at some point, I'll probably post those on Facebook, too. What's killing me is I posted that Thing commission, and it got, over 700 likes.
That was beautiful.
I love that
but
thing, though.
Most of the time, I'm fighting to hit 200 on some of these things, and I find out when I run things from my past that, like, because I ran, like, the whole story of some of my first printed comics work in a locally based science fiction magazine, and nothing. It was like, when tumbleweeds were blowing by and things like that. Yeah. So that's what I was saying earlier. You know, you don't make the mistake of thinking that it's about you. It's not. It's about things that people recognize from their own past and their own nostalgia, you know, things like that, and which is fine, but it was a learning curve for me that, because I did a series of posts on the development of the Strange Visitor character in Superman with the electric blue costume and stuff.
Yes.
And I was losing people with each chapter. I was losing more people, and I ended up never doing the final installment because nobody cared. So maybe a handful of guys cared, but you know, unfortunately, I would like to keep as many eyes on the page as possible. I want to keep the eyes on the page because when we actually start rolling out these new projects that I'm doing, the Blue Baron for Sitcomics, when we start rolling out these books, I want to use this as a tool to let people know where they can find the books and how they can get a hold of them and all that kind of stuff. You know, so
okay, sure.
Well, I'm one of the few people who do like the electric blue Superman, for the record. I know it's...
For something that everybody sort of kind of hated, I've been shocked at how many action figures they've done and how many people do speak up and say how much they enjoyed it and all that stuff, which is nice to hear, but, you know, I can understand this. You know, nobody needs Superman redesigned.
Sometimes you got to shake things up, maybe.
Well, then you understand it for what it is. That's why I don't understand why people get so worked up about it.
Yeah.
It's because, you know, somebody on Facebook even, you know, asked the question where, you know, was this one of these things where they changed it and it wasn't having the effect they wanted, so they switched it back. And it's like, seriously?
Well, you get that
at no
thing.
Point
yeah.
did anybody say, this is Superman. You know, oh, they said it. Let me correct that. They told us to say that. This is
right.
Superman now. But that's very carefully chosen words, you know.
Right.
I mean, but nobody thought we were going to keep him this way, even if it would have been the hugest hit in the history of comics, which it was not. we weren't going to keep him that way. You know, the plan to change him back always would have been scheduled for some anniversary issue. You know, it's
right.
the way it works.
It was.
What's interesting is how many people assume that was the mindset on the black costume in 252, and they forget that that came before all of that.
Right.
You know, when we did the black costume, I've told the story before. I know I haven't told it to you guys in this interview, but you may have heard the story before. But when they brought in the black costume in 252, and of course it wasn't going to be introduced in Secret Wars until like issue 8 or 9.
Right.
So, but at one point we were getting so much negative snail mail on just the rumor that we were going to change Spider-Man's costume. Nobody had seen the design yet, but everybody hated the idea, right? And at one point, Shooter came into DeFalco and said, "What issue were we introducing the black costume?" He said, 252. He said, "Get rid of it in 253. We are dying here. You know, people are talking about boycotting the book and all this kind of stuff. Just get it in and get it out." And DeFalco said, "Wait a minute. We can't do that." And he was, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Well, you're not even introducing it in Secret Wars until like issue 8. We've got to keep it for at least 8 or 9 months, or it's just bad storytelling. If we get rid of it in Amazing Spider-Man before you even introduce it in Secret Wars, what was the
right.
point?"
Right.
And Shooter had to, you know, he had to admit that that was perfect logic, you know. So, but that was the thing. He goes, "Okay, well, the month after it's introduced in Secret Wars, get rid of it." And Tom said, "Okay." And that's what we did. If you look to numbering on the books, that's exactly how long it stuck around, and that's exactly when we got rid of it. The problem being, not that it was really a problem, the problem being by the time those 8 months passed, everybody saw the costume
yeah.
and freaking loved it. So we still had it in the plan that we were, it's going to be a living thing, he's going to get rid of it and all that kind of stuff. But that's why the Black Cat gave him a cloth version of the costume, and he switched back and forth for a while because everybody, you know, it was whatever costume he was wearing, the fans wanted him to be wearing the other one. So we said, "Okay, well, then we'll just use both every once in a while," you know, that kind of thing. And that's why we did that, because, again, everything was snail mail. This was before the Internet. This was before cynical sales ploys and all that kind of jazz, you know. It was, we weren't sure that this was going to work at all, and there was a lot of panicking behind the scenes. But ultimately, you know, it turned out to be a big hit, you know.
Still look back at that Fox. I love that era, the alien suit, just Fox suit, switching back and forth is great. So let's talk about what you're working on now. Let's get into the current and the future of Ron Frenz.
Okay. I was contacted by a guy who works out in California as a writer producer on comedy shows. He started out as a production assistant on Seinfeld, and he has since worked on some British sitcoms, and he's currently working as the executive producer of a show called KC Undercover, which stars Zendaya, who was just in Spider-Man Homecoming. And his name is Darren Henry, and he is a huge comic book fan who grew up loving comics, Marvel comics, in the 70s. And he, foolishly or otherwise, wants to publish his own line of comics. And he's planning on publishing not just superhero comics, but also some humor comics and some, you know, all kinds of stuff. I mean, and he's doing kind of like, it's called Sit Comics, off of sitcom, because
right.
he's doing it kind of with a TV twist. You know, it's the book I'm working on is called The Blue Baron, and it is a straight superhero title in many, many, many ways, but it has kind of an interesting sitcom twist to it that I don't want to give too much away. If you haven't seen it, and if you have some interest, you know, you can either see it on Comixology or you can order copies. We did a test marketing in Central PA, which is where Darren is originally from, and sold some collectors versions of, you know, collectors versions of the first issue, and they sold very well, along with one of the comedy books called Super Suckers, which is about some college girls that find out that the same that they're dating the same guy, and then find out that that guy is a vampire, and now they are too. You know, that kind of thing. So he's got a whole bunch. He's doing like a zombie book that's got some humor to it. That's being done by one of the gentlemen that works for Mad Magazine. The Super Suckers is done in the style of the Archie comics. It's being done by Jeff Schultz, who worked for Archie. His superhero titles are being done by guys like me and Craig Rousseau, who worked on the Batman Adventures books and has done a lot of comics, and you see his work quite often out on social media and everything. He's terrific. He's doing one of the other superhero titles. And he's creating his own kind of superhero universe, but he's doing it in a very smart way, whereas he's not going to try to release a ton of titles all at once. And he's being very cautious in making sure he has plenty of material in the can before he starts rolling it out in physical comics. Starting next year, and it's hopefully next year, we're going to start rolling these books out. The humor books first, because that's kind of what he's known for, and then we'll start introducing the superhero characters. And I have high hopes for it. I think he's got a terrific writing voice. They're good, solid, straight superhero comics where you get to care about the characters, and there's, you know, certainly the humor of the best Marvel comics is included in the humor in the situations, like you see in the Marvel movies and things like that. But it's a lot of fun to work on. I'm having a gas because I don't have to apologize for my own natural inclinations of motion lines and impact marks and things like that. You know, he loves that stuff. That's what he wants, and it's nice to be working for somebody that's what they're looking for, you know. So it's very much in my wheelhouse. So like I said, I'm not doing a lot of shows right now. When the books start rolling out next year, we'll schedule as many conventions as people will have me, and we'll have some books with us, and we'll be able to talk about the new books as well as talk about the other stuff I've done and everything. But I've done a couple of posts for Blue Baron on Facebook, and again, because not too many people know about it, you know, I always provide links to the Sid Comics website and things like that, but you know, since people don't know about it, it can't be a part of their personal nostalgia, so those posts don't go over quite as well. But it gives me a chance to get some of the artwork out there and to kind of tease what's happening, and we'll see how it goes. Like I said, I would love for it to be a success, both for Darren and for myself, and you know, and the fact that he's out there in California and has connections in TV. Who knows? You know, that might be the best avenue for animation or live action or something like that. You know.
So how many issues are you in right now?
Actually, one of the things I think that is really interesting that he's doing is he's playing into the current talk on TV. He's calling them binge books. When they're released on Comixology, they're released as three chapters. You know, the issue 1.1, 1.2, 1.3. When they're going to be released as comics, and you can mail order the collector's edition version of issue number one, it's like a 50-page comic book for under $5.
Oh, cool.
And so it's very much beginning, middle, and an end full meal of story. There will be continuing subplots, and there will be continued stories and such. But the plan is to be quarterly books that will be 50-some pages. So, I am penciling the third issue, and I believe 2.2 just debuted. If it has debuted, if it hasn't, it will be in the next week or so debuting on online. So,
Great. And I see that Sal Buscema is also connected with it as well.
Actually, he being a child of the 70s, he called Sal to hire him to pencil it. And Sal was not interested in, is not all that interested in penciling anymore, except for some commissions occasionally. And, but we were finishing, wrapping up our Spider-Girl work, and he said, no, I'm not really interested in penciling, but if you get Ron Frenz to pencil it, I'll ink it. And fortunately, Darren knew my work from Spider-Girl and from other stuff, and, so he was happy with that arrangement. And, we set to work designing most of the characters. I'm involved in designing most of the characters for this, fairly large superhero universe that he's putting together that, it's a lot of fun. It really, really is something I'm enjoying working on, so.
And that's what matters most is that you've got to be enjoying what you're doing, right? You can't just...
Oh, absolutely. Especially in any creative endeavor.
Yeah.
If you're not enjoying it, I don't think you're doing your best work. Yeah. I would agree with that. And as we get closer to the rollout, I'll probably increase the frequency of showing some behind-the-scenes stuff and the design work and the characters and all that kind of jazz. But he's had conversations with Tom DeFalco about joining. He's actually working with Roger Stern on some stories now.
Oh, that's great.
So, yeah. Wow. He's
sounds great.
He's spending his own money to put this all together. And, you know, so for so many reasons, I would really love for this to be a success, not the least of which being that Darren's a great guy, and he's putting a lot of faith and trust in the work we can produce. So.
Oh, that sounds great. So, yeah, I'll definitely be looking out for that for sure.
Like I said, go to sitcomics.com and find out where all it's available. But I know Comixology is one of the things he talks about. So you can actually get a sample of what we're doing
and read it right there.
Perhaps do a review at some point on another podcast.
Sure. Yeah.
For sure.
It looks like a lot of fun. And what I like about it, and I say this to a lot of people in the comic shops, is it doesn't feel like they're trying to bring in the kids anymore to read the comics the way we were. And this looks like it's something that people of all ages would want to read and the kid would.
Oh, it's definitely an all ages book. And the fact that it has a 13-year-old protagonist, you know, is something that Tom DeFalco was always trying to bring back into comics too, is to give the kids characters that they can identify with. But see, the problem is, you know, you and I, all of us, I'm assuming from the conversation we've been having, we discovered comics at the 7-Eleven and the spinner rack at drugstores and such. And, you know, that is not there anymore.
No.
I mean, comics are now this, you have to go, you know, I think I'd really enjoy picking up a comic book. I think I'll call 1-800-COMIC-BOOK and find my local comic shop and hope that it's not a 2-hour drive away.
Yeah.
So I can be incredibly proactive and find some comic books.
Yeah.
And who's going to do that? I mean, at one point, one of the executives for Marvel that was no longer with the company, when they were doing Wolverine Origin and everything, actually said in a public interview that their job was just to produce the best material they could. It's up to the fans to find them. And it's like, can you think of any other entertainment form where, hey, we just produce this stuff. It's up to you to find us. That might give you a slight clue as to why the comics industry is in some trouble right now.
Wow.
Yeah, I was reading an article about it where they're starting to speculate whether or not Disney is going to continue publishing Marvel Comics. And one point that was made was that the comic book shop is a very exclusive place now, where if I was going in there for the first time wanting to get something, I would be too embarrassed to ask for help or to know where to start, because there's just so much there, and it seems very insulated. That was the word they used. And when I was young...
It's become more openly spoken about. I mean, people, you know the characters more than they ever did before and are familiar with them and stuff. But, yeah, you're right. The experience of going into a comic shop and expecting any kind of help when you walk over to that wall of color, where do you start anymore?
Yeah.
Seriously, where would you start? I go in and go, I'm kind of curious what's going on with the Avengers. I can't tell you which is the Avengers. Where is there a core Avengers title anymore? There's like, you know, there's one that ran for 12 issues, and then there's this one that's a 6-issue miniseries that you need before you read the new Avengers, which are this, and that was with this team, but this is a completely different thing. And, I mean, even the guys that work there can't really explain it to you in words of one syllable.
Yeah.
It's stunning. It's stunning.
The challenge.
I mean, thank God. I just went in because I remembered, oh, that's right, Stu Immonen's doing Spider-Man now. So I went in and bought the last several issues of Amazing Spider-Man. Thank God that was easy. I have had trouble, you know, I did have trouble finding copies of Spiral, that miniseries that that Jerry Conway did, because I was very curious to read that.
Oh, great. That was a lot of fun. That was good.
But, you know, I do have... So, I mean, I do feel that they're overproduced to some degree. I mean, I was a little dismayed to see that Stu Immonen's work was, it's colored where they're trying, it's a night scene. So you're not supposed to be able to see anything. And it's like, no, it's a night scene, so you can do it in blues, you know, or something really clever like that, something graphic like that, that clearly shows that it's night, but you can still see the line work, and you can still see what's going on, you know. So I do feel that sometimes the computer coloring and stuff can be overdone, and things can be overproduced a little much, you know.
Yeah.
Because I think part of what's going on with these characters is, you know, and you see comics fans reacting to it in the movies. Why are they so afraid of color?
Yeah.
You know, why are we afraid of Superman being right. Red and blue? You know, that's kind of why he's popular.
Exactly.
I think, even with the getting rid of the trunks, really, if somebody's going to pay $12 for a movie ticket, I think they've bought into the trunks, okay?
There we are.
Yeah.
So that kind of thing just... makes me a little crazy these days, too, you know, but we'll see. Because, you know, I don't know. Those are just things that I find kind of silly, because I don't think anybody, you know, when they say they want to see compelling Superman stories, and even if they want to see something a little more adult, there's plenty of material out there, there's plenty of ways to get that.
Yeah.
But... was there really people that weren't reading Superman because he was wearing red trunks?
Yeah, exactly.
I've never talked to anybody, and I haven't talked to everybody, but I've never talked to anybody who said, oh, I hated Superman for years because he had those damn red trunks. But once they got rid of the trunks, okay, you know, the floodgates were open, and now I buy every Superman title. You know, it's okay. You know,
yeah.
Never happened.
Yeah, you didn't see that big change in the electric blue era, did you? When he no longer had the suit at all.
Well, I mean, a lot of those stories, the reason they killed Superman, the reason they did electric blue Superman, were all to make people appreciate Superman. It's like you play with the character and you give them something a little different for a while, and hopefully one of the responses they have is, gain some appreciation of the character, you know. I mean, that's kind of what we tried to do with Eric being Thor, too. It was never about not finding the real Thor. So, you know, the people that were saying, well, that's ridiculous. You know, that's not Thor. And we know it's not Thor. Read the story. That's one of the things Eric's always saying. I'm not Thor. Right. I want to find the real Thor.
Right?
Yeah. Sorry, Martin. Go ahead.
No, it's okay. Finish your thought.
I was just going to say, I think sometimes one of the things that is a fault for these characters, you can publish books and, you know, people are buying them. Some people just continue buying them because they've always done it. They're not even reading it anymore. But in the case of something like the Fantastic Four, for instance, I think when they do come back, it'll be the best thing that ever happened to take them away from everybody so that they can now appreciate what they mean to the Marvel Universe and do them justice.
If they can put together a team that can communicate that in story through the characters, that'd be fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, that would be great if they could do, you know, because they've had some teams that have been on there that have done a pretty nice job of recapturing some of the original thrill of some of those stories, and you know, there are still people out there alive who have written some really good Fantastic Four stuff. Be nice if they gave them some phone calls, you know.
Yeah.
And if the 700 and some likes I got on that shot of the thing is any indication. You've got some people out there hankering for some Fantastic Four stuff, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a definite audience now that are waiting for it. They feel the void.
Yeah.
They feel the void now.
Well, but it would be a great opportunity in the midst of what they're stated purpose is to do these legacy books and to get the books back to what they were supposed to be. I foolishly thought when I read those press releases that they might be contacting guys like Marv Wolfman and Len Wein and Tom DeFalco and, you know, people that are still out there active, Mark DeMatteis, and yeah, you know, involve some of them in plans to bring these characters back to who they could be, you know, that kind of thing, and kind of get the Marvel Universe back on an even keel after this last Secret Wars. And reintroducing the Fantastic Four could be an incredible tool in doing that, in recapturing the spirit of the Marvel Universe, because they are the spirit of the Marvel Universe.
Yeah.
Ben Grimm alone is the heart and soul of the Marvel Universe, or used to be, you know.
Right.
I mean, if you would have told any of us 10 years ago there was going to be a time when there would be a Marvel Comics, but they wouldn't be publishing Fantastic Four, you would have told them they were crazy.
Yeah. It's almost like it should always be published, even if only one person is buying it. Because it's Fantastic Four. Yeah.
It would have been nice. Like, if, like, Wonder Woman, you know, it's, well, we have to keep publishing it or we'll lose the copyright, you know, that kind of thing. Whatever. Let it be a lost leader, you know. But get a good team on it that understands, you know, you hear everybody talk about, well, it's all about exploration and family. Yeah, but what does that mean? You need somebody that actually knows what that means.
Right.
And I swear to God, if they relaunch the book and 3 issues in, somebody leaves or the team is broken, and all, if they can't just do good Fantastic Four stories for at least the first 2 years, then don't even start.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's one thing during a run to you know, change up the lineup and all that kind of stuff. But if you're going to reintroduce the book, one, make sure it's all, you know, if you want to do a Thing miniseries that leads into a relaunch of the FF or something, then fine. But by the time you relaunch the FF, please have it be the original four in Four Freedoms or the Baxter Building or whatever the hell you want to put them. Pier 4 I thought was a nice touch back in the day. You know, wherever you want to put them, have them together as a family, write some good stories that don't involve anybody dying or quitting or being replaced, and write some really good Fantastic Four stories. If you got to go back and you got to reread the first 100 issues to figure out what a good Fantastic Four story is, then do it. Read that. Read Mark Waid stuff. Read John Byrne stuff. Read the original Stan Lee stuff. And if you don't come out of that with any ideas, then don't touch it.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's true. I just finished reading the Mark Waid run, and I loved it. It was great. And I was late coming to the Fantastic Four, but I'm now binge reading them, and I can't wait for them to come back. I don't know what you guys think, but I have... I think Dan Slott could pull it off. But I could be wrong. Just because he might have a voice for
Dan Slott is something that the only work of his that I'm really familiar with is his current Spider-Man run, and he and I have some intrinsic differences on how we see Peter Parker. But beyond that, that's very possible. I don't know. I don't know what he would do on Fantastic Four. I enjoyed his She-Hulk stuff, and I've enjoyed some of the other work he's done, you know, but I don't know. I'd have to recuse myself on that opinion. But certainly there are people out there who have written some really good Fantastic Four material, and they're still active in the industry. For God's sakes, call them, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Mark Waid would be great. Another one,
for sure.
Anyway,
it doesn't feel like that long, but we've been definitely going for a while now. We've covered a lot of the listener questions that I've asked, I think, with our conversation. But there's a couple that I wanted to get in before we wrap things up. I'm gonna sort of paraphrase and bring a few questions together because they're a little bit about the process, if that's okay.
Sure.
So Sue asks, where do you do your drawing? Do you listen to music? Who do you listen to if you do? Do you eat any snacks?
And do you have a lucky pen or pencil or charm?
No. I have no lucky pencil, pen, or charm. When you've been doing this as long as I have, you realize that the tools are secondary to the person that's using them. So, I used to stick to certain pencils and certain lead weights and things, and I don't worry about any of that stuff anymore. Right. I like a medium weight lead, nothing too hard, nothing too soft. I'm right up the middle when it comes to that kind of thing. I have a separate studio space that I rent that I used to share, that I mentioned that I used to share with Pat Olive. I've continued it myself. So I get out of my apartment and I go there. It's two or three blocks from where I live, and I camp out in there. If I listen to music, it's just the radio, and I usually turn it off because once you start hearing the same ads every hour on the hour, it starts to drive me crazy, so I turn it off. I don't have a CD player over there currently, and I'm not a fan of any particular band or artist that I could say that that's what I listen to or anything like that. Back in the day when I used to work out of my house, I still have a studio room here in my apartment. When I used to do that, I would listen to soundtracks a lot. I would buy up, everything from Star Wars to Indiana Jones to Star Trek, the original Star Trek, the motion picture, to Conan, the Basil Pallidorus soundtrack to the original Conan, things like that. That's what I would play in the background while I was working. When Pat and I were working together, he liked to have the radio on, or he would play his own music, and he had a lot of favorite bands and stuff. But I also would come to realize that he would tend to zone out. And if he had the radio on even one of his stations or something, and I would react to something somebody said on the radio station, he wasn't listening. He would go, what? No,
background noise. Yeah,
it would just became, it would become background noise, and as he got more into the work, he'd kind of zone out. So yeah. I'm afraid I don't have anything interesting to throw out there. I don't have any lucky charms of any kind.
Lucky charms.
I surround myself with inspiration. I mean, my studio, has everything from full color stickers up on the wall of the different characters from the 60s and 70s to my own commissions and pinups that I like, and covers and pages, to things that I see at like Kinko's or something. They just did a series of these little posters of DC covers, classic DC covers that I bought, and you go to some of these houseware places and they have these wooden plaques that are like classic Marvel covers and things like that.
I've seen those, yeah.
I've bought those and hang them around the studio. And, I do surround myself with the things that inspire me,
Understrike.
And like I said, anytime I take a break, I have stacks and stacks of comics and all of the whole run of the essentials and stuff that I'll pick up and read through. And I mean, because actually when I started working with the Sit Comics, I wanted to kind of reacclimate myself to the 70s, to kind of see how much, God, they got so much story in the 20-some pages,
Yeah, they were. Yeah.
And they weren't doing the pin-up shots and everything, and yet it still had so much energy and so much action. I mean, Sal's entire run on the Hulk, for God's sakes, is just amazing. Amazing how much story content they would get into a single issue. It was amazing. So, I'm constantly learning and constantly associating myself with the stuff that got me into comics. I mean, that's one of the fun things about it, is to rediscover something from your childhood and realize you almost feel that same way again. There it is. There you get that hit of nostalgia of, God, I remember looking at this when I was a kid. And so I get it. When fans talk about that, I get it. I mean, I'm not so removed from it working professionally in it that I don't understand that connection. So.
The other question I have here, I think it's more around the Comic-Con shows. So, and I think you already talked a little bit about this before, or you mentioned a story, but do you have any funny traveling or show stories?
I will use an old classic.
Okay.
This was one of my favorite stories. We were remember what convention it was at. We were at a convention. DeFalco and I were at the convention. We were waiting for an elevator with Len Wein, okay, name dropping. The three of us are waiting for an elevator, and this group comes up of a whole group of people dressed as the X-Men.
Okay.
From the 80s. And so one of them was the one of the John Romita Jr. or Mark Silvestri versions of Rogue. Okay, had the short hair with the white swatch in it, and the green tunic, the black leggings, and all this kind of stuff, right? And at one point, we're all waiting for the elevator, and Rogue has reason to bend over, and DeFalco saw me look over and kind of like stop and notice. So as Rogue stands up, DeFalco thinks he's going to do me a favor, and he goes, "You're hurting my friend." And oh, she no. goes, "Excuse me?" And he goes, "Oh, it's just my friend was appreciating your costume." And I'm looking for something to say because this idiot has gotten me into this conversation. So I said, "Well, I'm never going to be able to draw Rogue the same way again, you know, draw Rogue a lot or anything." But then she turns back to DeFalco and goes, "So when did you realize?" And Tom goes, "What? Realize what?" And she goes, "When did you realize I'm a man?" And DeFalco goes white. His eyes are bulging, and he just goes pale. He has no idea what to say.
Oh, wow.
He's just doing the old classic, homina, 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 you know, that kind of thing. And the elevator finally comes. All the X-Men get on the elevator. And Rogue says, "Are you guys coming?" Because we were going up to the penthouse to go to a party that everybody was invited to.
Right.
And she goes, "You guys coming?" And it looks full. We'll be along in a second. And the elevator doors close. And Len Wein and Todd DeFalco and I are standing there alone again. And we're all looking at each other like, "Holy shit." And DeFalco says, "You know, I'm not even upset to find out that I was attracted to a man. But I did always think that I would be able to tell the difference."
Right.
And the three of us, as the elevator shows up again, as we're going up in the elevator, DeFalco swears us all to secrecy. You know, "We're not going to talk about this, are we?" And Len Wein goes, "No, I'm not going to talk about this with anybody." Says, "No, we're not going to talk about this." So we get up to the party and we separate. We're all mingling and all this kind of stuff. And at one point, somebody else, I don't remember who, comes over to me and goes, "So I understand you met Rogue." And I'm going,
"It was that.
What? How did you hear about that?"
Oh,
and
yeah.
The person points, and I go walking over, and DeFalco's holding court, telling everybody the story.
Oh.
And I said, "Didn't you just swear us to secrecy about that?" And he goes, "Oh, what the hell?" You know, that kind of thing. And the next time I visited the Marvel offices, he had this framed picture up in his office of that group of X-Men, and Rogue had signed it for him.
Amazing.
And it was just wonderful. But it turns out that he was wearing a plastic ass. So it really was perfect. So what can I say?
Oh,
what
boy.
Can I say?
That's
so that was one.
That's a great story.
And there, you know, it's crazy. It's an amazing experience to back in the day when Mark Gruenwald was still with us. And he would kind of be the cruise director when there was a big contingent of Marvel guys there. And there was this amazing sense of camaraderie and this amazing sense of community. And he would do this crazy stuff called like the Marvel Olympics, where we would just play games for the enjoyment. We would involve people from the audience, and we'd get these nice big crowds in these meeting rooms, and we'd just make complete idiots of ourselves and have fun. And I miss it. I miss it a lot. But I'm so grateful that I got to be in on the tail end of that. You know what
yeah.
I mean? I can't tell you how grateful I am that I got to encounter you know, at least a permutation of the Marvel bullpen and that part of that original vibe coming in the 80s, and that we still had newsstand sales. You know, I got to experience newsstand sales, which was, you know, wonderful. I mean, even though my first project, KSR, was one of the first experiments with direct sale only and stuff, but that was one of the weird things about the numbers is, you know, Walt killed in direct sales in the comic shops. You know, that's the stuff everybody loved that. But when we actually started doing what we were doing on Thor, we were actually doing a little better on newsstand than Walt was. So that was very gratifying. I mean, he still kicked our ass in direct sales, but on the regular newsstand, you know, it's kind of like one of the things that people have talked about with when Romita took over and kind of took Spider-Man to the next level from Ditko, because Ditko could be kind of an odd experience for people that were reading traditional comics. You know, you pick up a Ditko comic and it's like, what's going on here? And you either really liked it or it could potentially put you off. But when Romita came on board and, you know, the characters became more glamorous in the truest sense of that word, you know, they all the characters became more attractive, the women became more gorgeous, Spider-Man became more heroic, it became more of a traditional look for the comic, and I think that's one of the things that kind of opened up Spider-Man's popularity a bit more. And you have to be, you know, aware of that kind of thing. So these people that are genius, like a Ditko or a Walt Simonson, and are very individualistic, you know, there may be an element of them in the mass market that might be a little too individualistic. I don't know. I mean, Walt certainly having no trouble with his career. So more power to him. I mean, he's a fantastic guy. He really is. And I owe Wheezy everything, so... Yeah. I have nothing bad to say. I have nothing bad to say about anybody in this industry, to tell you the truth. So
that's good.
That's a great company.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not saying that.
I'm saying the company of people.
Yes, I've had some great company in my time in this industry. You know, it's interesting because there are these people on Facebook and everything that if it's Marvel, it must suck, and if you were dealing with Marvel, it must suck. And I said, no, I don't see it that way at all. And they said, well, you've had much more positive experiences. And I said, it's not about that. I've met plenty of idiots in my time in the industry, but they're idiots that work for Marvel.
Right.
It's not
right.
Marvel. I never felt like Marvel was out to get me.
Right, right.
You know, it's. I mean, believe me, Mark Gruenwald desperately, I was under contract when Thunderstrike got canceled. And Mark Gruenwald desperately tried to find me other work so I could stay on contract with Marvel. It just was not to be. I was lucky, and Mike Carlin called and asked me if I wanted to come over and do Superman, and he saved my life because, hell yes. So, you know, I've been lucky that way, but, you know, Marvel didn't have it out for me. You know, it's just the circumstance of the time. That was Ron Perlman's people who decided if you cancel half the line, the half that's left will sell twice as well.
Yeah, that worked out well.
And when Tom DeFalco sat there in that meeting and laughed out loud when somebody said that, he realized, oh, my God, you're serious. And he told me that was the moment he knew that he was not long for the company, that he
right.
would be fired as editor-in-chief, because the Perlman people had no idea what they were doing. Because, you know, DeFalco tried to tell him, no, if you cancel half the line, they don't just, you know, if they really enjoy the Mighty Thor, they're just not going to pick up another title. They're going to use that money to buy a soda and a piece of pizza.
Yeah.
You know, so your Marvel is losing that money if you can't. Mm-hmm. These aren't cans of beans that are easily replaceable. And they had no interest in listening to them. So. And Marvel lost a lot of market share over that.
Yeah. I do have one last question. So I've asked the last few interviews the same question, and I think I've predicted the answer, but we'll see if I'm right. I told Eric before. What's your favorite donut?
What's my favorite donut?
Yeah.
Do people actually have favorite donuts?
They do.
Yeah.
I would have to go. I mean, we talk in brand and type and flavor and stuff, or what?
You could go into as much detail as possible, but
I would have to. The first thing that occurred to me, I mean, because I love something with chocolate icing, and I can love a cake donut with chocolate icing, but I would have to say, if you put a gun to my head for my favorite donut, it would be a Krispy Kreme glaze.
Okay.
possibly reheated just for a couple of seconds. You know?
Oh yeah, those are good.
That would probably
or when the red light's on and you're just coming out.
But yeah, there you go. There
it's
you
a Canadian go. Thing. What can I say?
Yeah.
Oh,
Canadian
okay.
Donuts.
I'll have to remember that the next time. If I'm ever dating a Canadian woman, I'll have to remember.
There
bring
you
up donuts.
We're a cheap date.
Thank you so much, Ron, for being so generous with your time. I could talk to you all day. This is great.
Well, it was my pleasure, guys, really. I hope you get something you can use and edit down to something coherent.
Oh, I'm using
and,
it all.
It was a lot of fun. It's always fun talking comics, especially with guys who know what they're talking about. So I appreciate it.
Great. Hopefully
thank you so
can,
much.
Come back to the show soon.
Well, you're very welcome, and it was my pleasure, and anytime. All right? Good luck to you guys.
Thank you so much, Ron.
So let's be honest, how much fun is it to be able to listen to Ron Friends talk about comics? I mean, I could have sat there all day asking him questions and just chit-chatting with the guy. It was fantastic. I hope everybody enjoyed it. And we thank everyone for once again joining us over here at the Cave of Solitude. And we're happy and hoping to bring you more good interviews in the near future. And don't forget to leave a review for us on iTunes or leave a listener email at caveofsolitude@outlook.com. I want to send a special shout out to my buddy Martin Slam Duncan over at this Fastball Special. Don't forget to check out his latest episode with content from Montreal Comic Con. Now, if anybody's interested in reading some of Ron Friend's classic material, it's all been collected in the Epic Collections from Marvel Comics, both the Spider-Man run as well as the Thor run. I think the latest Epic Collection of Thor has just hit the stores this month. You can pick that up. Don't forget as well to check out his latest work at Sitcom Comics. As he mentioned, he's working on an all-ages book called The Blue Baron, and it'll be nice to be able to see some new work coming from Mr. Ron Friends. And hopefully once that book drops and they launch the entire line, we'll be able to have him over at one of our cons over here in Toronto. Thank you everyone again for listening. I have been your host, Eric Anthony. We will be back soon, and I promise Daff J will be returning to the show, so stay tuned for that. Take care, everybody.